Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Science Facts and Fallacies 200, joined as always by Dr. Kevin Folta. My name is Cameron English. Kevin, how exciting is this? We can see each other's faces, and we're going to talk about science.
Both things. Yeah, it's pretty weird because like we've never done this before. Like we always talk just to each other ear to ear and that's it, you know? And so it's kind of fun, you know, kind of see what, you know, get verbal, nonverbal cues that others can't see. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And people may not know this. Kevin and I have actually never met in person, mainly because we live on the other side of the country. So this is a big deal. I feel very excited to be having a face-to-face-ish conversation with you today.
Yeah, face-to-face is dictated by the COVID pandemic. This is the new definition of face-to-face, right? But it is really nice to be able to do this, and hopefully that the video medium will allow us to have more viewership because it's great to have podcasts, audio, but people find these things in video places. So it just is another way that we can extend science better, and I'm glad we're doing it. So we'll see how it works this week and maybe keep on trucking. Sounds good.
Absolutely. This is the face of the corporate shill. Just kidding. I'm not one of those. Okay. So we've got three stories to talk about as always. Kevin is the author of the first one, which is a very big one. So we're talking about biotech chestnut tree poised to restore lost ecosystems and biodiversity, but it needs your help. Next up, acetaminophen linked to autism. Claims about the causes of this behavioral disease get weirder as researchers hone in on genes as the driving culprit. And finally, Fox's Tucker Carlson and the far right link vaccines to NFL player DeMar Hamlin's cardiac arrests. Oh boy, always love the controversy, Kevin. But let's start with some good news. We're talking about this biotech chestnut tree. Finally, after all these years, it's close to prime time, I guess.
Yeah, this is and so we'll start with facts before fallacies. It warms the cockles of my heart to see this happening. What we're looking at is the APHIS deregulation or the APHIS approval, USDA APHIS approval of the biotech chestnut tree. So why do we need a biotech chestnut tree? Well, the American chestnut dominated U.S. forests across Appalachia for forever, right? This was a dominant tree in the forest in most places. And it was said that an ambitious squirrel who really wanted to could travel from Georgia, north end of Georgia, all the way to Maine, just on the branches of chestnut trees. And it was a dominant tree. 25% of the wood in the forest was an American chestnut. Well, in the early 1900s, or actually probably happened a little before that, there was an import of Chinese chestnut that brought a blight along with it. So a fungal disease. They really first discovered it in the Bronx Zoo. And from there, it was about 50 years before every American chestnut tree was gone. And they're not really gone. They're just suppressed. The fungus kills the aerial portion of the tree. So the roots are still there, and they put up little suckers here and there that still allow the genetics to be present. But they never grow and they never reproduce. And so here comes biotechnology. And so Bill Powell, Dr. William Powell and others at the State University of New York in Syracuse, they came up with the idea that could we use biotechnology to engineer a tree to resist the fungus? Not by making the tree more defensive, you know, per se with all the defense genes, but by giving it an enzyme that comes from wheat that specifically targets the way that the fungus invades. Seems pretty simple. The nice part about this is that you're not killing the fungus, so you're not changing the ecology of fungi, you know, fungal ecology. You're just making it not kill the tree. You're neutralizing its weapon, basically, is the way it's done. And so this has been in the works for a long time. The gene comes from wheat, I neglected to mention. So it works. It's beautiful. Trees grow right through the pathogen. It's all been done in controlled environments and even outside in controlled trials outside. And it looks awesome. And here we have an opportunity to repatriate the Appalachian American forests with this tree that's gone and restore the ecosystems that were there. Why it's important is because we always talk about biotech and, you know, medicine and agriculture. Here's a stellar application in conservation. And here's a way that we can use it to restore an ecosystem back to the way it was. So, you know, that's really the stepping off point.
It's really cool stuff. And I want to add, before we get too far into this, this is one of the few projects that has gotten some surprising endorsements. And I'm talking, of course, about the Sierra Club, which came out, I believe it was last year. And they said, you know, we're still not crazy about this whole GMO thing, but on balance, this is worth the limited risk it poses. And I remember reading that. And I think a lot of people in our circles, Kevin, were like, that's what we've been saying for like 30 years. Just do a risk assessment. And just say, yeah, you know, this is worth the limited risk that it poses, and it's going to do a whole bunch of good for ecology and for our forests. It's great. So talk about the significance of that. What does that signify that it's that such a big name in the environmental movement comes out and endorses this?
No, it's very true. And it's not just the Sierra Club. It's also the Nature Conservancy, a number of other groups that typically would be very dubious about biotechnology have been really excited about this application. And it's because it's a solution to restoring ecology, something that we disrupted by inviting a foreign pathogen. And it's, so it's a problem we created, and now we can come up with a solution. There's perfect symmetry here. And I think that's why it seems so acceptable. So, and it's also not a, it's also not, even though if you read the public comments, it's not Monsanto, right? This is a team of people, not just one. It actually started a while ago. In the early 1990s, this idea was pitched. It's a group of scientists that love the forest, and they're doing their part to use the tools they have to make it happen. So I think it's real positive.
It's great. It's great. And I want to encourage people, the USDA APHIS, as Kevin mentioned, they did a very thorough analysis of this. I mean, regulators have looked at this backwards and forwards. And I read that document. It was long. I almost fell asleep. But they went through every concern, and they were very respectful. They were nicer than I would have ever been. But they went through and they said, no, this is wrong. No, this is wrong. No, this is wrong. Like every possible argument, as clever as you might think it is, they just demolished it. And they did it with the kind of expertise that you would expect a regulator to display. It was great. So I would encourage everybody to read that just so you can get up to date on this. Now, Kevin, where are we at in the process? The title of the story says it's poised to hit the forest at some point. Like, what are we actually looking at in terms of time?
Well, right now you're looking at formal deregulation happening sometime within the next year or two. And that is after it goes through this last regulatory round. And the important part here is that there's a public comment period. And it originally ended December 27th. I'm talking biotech. We interviewed one of the scientists on the project. So if you have more interest, check it out there. Actually, I interviewed Bill Powell back in 2015. On Talking Biotech. So now we're in our eighth year. He was one of our first guests because this is such an important application. It was also, I believe, episode 375 or 376. So worth checking out. Where we are in the process is a public comment period where the USDA solicits public comment as part of their approval process. And they do weigh public comment kind of heavily. It's a good indicator as to how they have to, I don't want to say sell, but how they want to think about this. And the folks who are against it are there. They're putting up copy and paste, boilerplate. We hate this. It's Monsanto's tree. You know, they're busy at it. And what we don't have is enough thoughtful scientific comments. So even if you could take your time, a line or two, You know, just write a couple sentences saying that you support what is a ecologically beneficial application of biotechnology that poses virtually no risk compared to the benefit. And they would be really appreciated. And you have to go to regulations.gov, and then you have to go to, you put in the search field this, in this number, APHIS-2020-0030. So that catchy number and APHIS for APHIS, -2020 for the year they submitted their application 3 years ago, -0030. So this is a where you can put in your 2 cents, and I would really encourage you to do that. They've extended the comment period based upon requests from people who are against it. So it's kind of a good time to put in some comments for it. And if you could do that, learn a little bit more. And whether you are for it or against it, write your most thoughtful comments and use the reasoning behind it and the evidence that you want to share. So that would be really great.
And before we move on, I think that's a really good point. It underscores that you actually can participate in this process. And people are probably inclined to say, well, the government doesn't really care what I think, and they're not going to listen to my comments. But if you read the reports they put out about any of this technology, they look at this. The regulators that are responsible for approving or denying these sorts of projects, they read these comments. Now, if you say something offensive and you copy and paste something from a blog that you read, they're probably not going to take that seriously. But they do look at what people say. And you can, when you read their responses, they'll say, you know, some commenters express this thought, blah, 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 and they react to it. So you can be involved in the process. It's not secret or hidden. I think that's important.
Yeah, let me throw in one more comment. A lot of folks do worry that, okay, this tree is one tree and it's a clone that they're making of this tree, and it's just going to take over the forest with clones, so there's no diversity and all that stuff. What's really cool is I mentioned before that there are existing trees, American chestnut trees, that are there but not growing very well. And there's a possibility that if you can repatriate areas with this tree and knock down the fungus and be able to plant some other trees around there or bring back some of the natives in a protected environment, that you could restore the native ecosystem to the point where the transgene is no longer relevant. And there's also been some identification of American chestnuts in Delaware and Maine, those are the two that I'm aware of, that do not have genetic engineering that can grow through the blight. So it's happening naturally where, you know, genetic variation that's happening and the little weird cells that come up out of the ground as a sucker of an American chestnut are able to fight back against the blight. And so that kind of natural variation that's happening will be great to study. And in tandem with a genetic engineering solution, restore the forest for generations to come.
Yeah, you broke into your Vern Blasek there for a second. Okay, so let's talk about acetaminophen causing autism, apparently. This is everything causes autism, Kevin. Vaccines, pain relievers, glyphosate.
Well, you know, if an attorney is making a claim in a class action suit that something causes something, it usually is something very amorphous that isn't specific. And autism is an excellent candidate for that. We'll talk about that in a second. So what they're looking at here is the recent spate of lawsuits that have been made against CVS, Walgreens, Walmart by, I think, 19 different district courts in the United States that are keying on the idea that acetaminophen has a link. There's the weenie word, right? Link.
Yep.
To autism. And what they were looking at, what they're really keying off of, is a European Journal of Epidemiology paper that was a meta-analysis where they took all these different studies that had these very sometimes small effect and other times no effect. And if you group them together in the right way and mash the numbers together in a certain way, you can get some sort of outcome. And a meta-analysis can be an extremely powerful way to look at data, but it also can be very deceptive. And we've seen examples where people have put together data that you really can't fit together. They're not doing an apples to apples mashing of multiple data sets. They're putting things together that you can't really put together. And when you do that, you get results that can be skewed. In this case, this paper originally came out. They said that there was 21% higher likelihood of autism and 19% higher likelihood of ADHD in women who took Tylenol, you know, acetaminophen, which is different than, ibuprofen. Yes, we can talk about that. During their pregnancy. Okay, so what's the deal with Tylenol? What is this, or acetaminophen? What is acetaminophen? This is the active ingredient in Tylenol. It's the brand of pain reliever. And it is usually the only one that women who are pregnant are allowed to take, that they don't want you taking NSAIDs. So non-steroidal anti-inflammatories are off the table, except for maybe low-dose aspirin, like 81 milligrams a day, maybe to ensure placental health. There's some good data on that. But acetaminophen is usually recommended and NSAIDs off the table. So aspirin, ibuprofen, naproxen off the table. They have you take acetaminophen. And this is the one that has allegedly been tied to autism. The way they made this, the difference is that Tylenol is not an anti-inflammatory. It works as a painkiller, as a fever reducer, but it doesn't work as an anti-inflammatory, whereas ibuprofen and aspirin, naproxen, all those NSAIDs do. Okay, so the funny part is, the ironic part is that the acetaminophen is what physicians will prescribe or will recommend to women during pregnancy who are experiencing unusual pain. And you get a lot of pains during pregnancy, back pain. I'm speaking from experience, not me, but from seeing it. There's parts of you that get horribly heavy and you got to lug them around the house. And you get, sore back, sore knees, all the stuff that didn't hurt before starts to hurt. And as your joints are changing and loosening and everything's kind of moving right, you get some aches and pains, and doctors may allow the use of acetaminophen. So this study, they looked at something like 75,000 or 74,000 women child pairs, and they asked questions about the use of acetaminophen and the incidence of behaviors on the autism spectrum from age 4 to 12. And they compared those two and said, if you took acetaminophen at a certain frequency, how well did that reflect in the presentation of autism symptoms? And so they found this association. And with that is enough to start filing lawsuits. And so that's really the stepping off point for that story.
Yeah, I can also testify to pregnancy pains. And I remember one particular incident. My wife was walking down the hallway while she was pregnant with our son. She didn't know I could see her around the corner. And she dropped a book or something on the ground. And she tried just for a second to go down and get it. And then she just went, oh! So as I went to pick up the book, I laughed. Because, it's just funny, and I sympathize with her. But, yeah, it's important to have these kind of drugs available. Anyways, back to this paper, though. Did they speculate about a mechanism? I know they weren't looking for one, but in the discussion section, did they say this is why we think this might happen, or did they just kind of leave it at the association?
They left it at the association level. There wasn't any particular mechanisms that were recommended, because the problem with this is on several levels. One is that autism is not a thing. It's like when you talk about cancer. Right. There are different cancers and different etiologies whereas autism can be any one of a variety of social behaviors, and I don't want to say disorders, because it's just variation that's happening. There are different, some people call it autism spectral disorder. It's really things that are happening that are either cognitive or behavioral that are put on this spectrum. So it's very difficult to classify and tie a specific disorder to a specific cause. But the bigger problem here is that when women are reporting that they are users of acetaminophen, what it says is that there's a reason that they're taking acetaminophen. And is there something behaviorally that they're doing? Is it something, you know, some other cause that's causing them to require a pain reliever that could be the cause of, or trigger of autism spectrum? Or are there certain behaviors that are more prevalent than others, or certain, you know, issues that are defined as autism? So it's really, really hard to put one and one together here. It's interesting, but to me, it looks like something where you need a whole lot more data. I'm not discounting it. It could be real, but I don't see this as definitive and a reason for people to not take acetaminophen. I'm not recommending that. I'm not a physician, but I certainly do see this as very fertile ground for attorneys to start filing lawsuits.
Oh boy. By the way, I think the $5 phrase for what you're talking about is a confounding variable, right? There's just some other thing that's actually causing the problem, and you look at something that may be associated with it, but it's not, doesn't have any influence on what's actually happening. Is that right?
That's right. So there's ice cube. Since there's so many confounding variables, it's hard to really compare apples to apples. And especially in an atmosphere where, well, you know, the MIT researcher said that there would be 50% of kids had autism by 2025 because of glyphosate. So there's always something that's very easy to tie to autism. Yeah. And unfortunately, it takes our eye off the ball, because what it really is coming out is that when you start looking at the genetics of autism, it's complicated. But there are something like 60 or more loci, genetic or genes or locations on chromosomes, I should say, that are associated with autism spectral disorder. So with different aspects of autism behaviors. And what it says is that the genetics are just as complex as the behaviors and the associated physiology, the cognitive issues that are observed. And so you can't just say it's caused by one thing that triggers this. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but it's very unlikely because it's such a complex spectrum of disorders. You may be able to tie use of acetaminophen to one type of disorder, one type of behavior, but right now it's too amorphous. And if there is an environmental trigger, glyphosate, acetaminophen, anything, these things that are proposed, it would have to happen on a genetic predisposition or a genetic overlay. And right now I just see, I see attorneys going to court, filing lawsuits to try to get a decision, try to get a settlement where they walk away with millions or billions, and every former user of Tylenol gets a $1.25 check in the mail.
And nothing gets fixed. Nothing gets better. You don't actually find what may be causing the problem. You just enrich some dishonest lawyers in the process. Okay. Well, I guess we'll have to keep following this. I do wonder, though, all of the anti-groups that have blamed this on autism, you know, they blame it on glyphosate, they blame it on certain vaccines or, you know, certain ingredients in vaccines. Do they just say that all of these things contribute now, or do they have to change their mind? They're like, okay, it wasn't the vaccines, it's really Tylenol. And, you know, I just don't know how they, if they even try to make sense of all that.
Yeah. We left vaccines out, didn't we? Yeah. It's always easy, and this is the problem, is that when we have a problem like autism, like cancer, like any kind of time there's a loss that's due to something that people don't have a basis for, an etiology for, you know, why did this happen? Why did this happen? We want to know why. And some things just aren't answerable at this time. But you can't blame parents for wanting to know why. And the folks who are signing on to this, when you read some of the comments in the associated literature, it's a lot of parents saying, well, I took Tylenol during pregnancy, right. You know, but who hasn't taken Tylenol in the last year? I know I haven't, because it's hard on the liver, and I kind of stay away from it because I do other things that are hard on my liver. So, well, you know, working in chemistry and all this stuff I do, I work with chloroform all the time. I work with, alcohols in different capacities. It's one of these things that they advise you kind of be cool with that stuff. So but just about everybody is some exposure to acetaminophen. It should be noted that the kids who took acetaminophen, which children's Tylenol is a very popular drug, between 0 and 18 months did not exhibit any autism-associated symptoms. So it's not necessarily, so they did have that contrast to put against what they believe they saw in the prenatal exposure.
Very good. Well, there you go. Another scandal, another fairy tale. I don't know what to call it, Kevin, but let's talk about Damar Hamlin. What happened to this guy, first of all, and then let's talk about the claims about the vaccine injury.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting because he had experienced. So here's what we know for sure. And there's a lot we don't know about this because it wasn't immediately clear. No one's talked about, you know, what actually happened. The data have been really, the explanations have been few and far between. All we know is that he initiated a tackle and underwent a cardiac arrest. And during that cardiac, I should mention this article is from Alex Woodward on Yahoo News and the original article. And Hamlin had a cardiac arrest on the field after making a tackle. He, and everybody's seen it, tackled the wide receiver, stood up, staggered, and fell down. And when I saw this, I immediately said two words, commotio cordis. That was what I thought right away. And maybe we should talk about, you know, what that is, just because it's kind of an interesting thing. So commotio cordis is a disorder that happens or an event that happens when you're struck in the chest during repolarization of the ventricle. So when the ventricular myocardium is repolarizing, so you know that waveform you see when you have heartbeat, you know, you see that first thing, that boing, 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 and then a little bump, the QRS complex, and then a little thing they call the T wave. That's a repolarization of the ventricles. It's an electrical thing in the heart. And if you are struck in the heart physically, precisely during the 15 milliseconds of the ascent of the T wave, that little bump going up, if you were hit in the chest at exactly that time, it could cause a disruption in the electrical conductivity of the heart and stop it instantly. And it happens a lot in youth baseball. I mean, not a lot. It's rare. It's exceedingly rare. But when it happens in youth baseball. Kid gets hit in the chest with a baseball, hockey pucks, lacrosse ball, martial arts. That's where we learned about it. You get punched in the chest right at that, and you drop like a bag of flour. You can see YouTube videos of people dropping from commotio cordis. It's not a you stagger for a second and then drop. There's hockey players who it's happened in the NHL. So this is something that is very well understood and documented in athletes, and something that could have happened here with Hamlin. And it fits very well the profile. So the unfortunate part of this is that now you have a healthy human being, the healthiest specimen of a human you can have, who drops with cardiac arrest on the field. And right away, all the anti-vaxxers, all the anti-COVID vaccine folks, he must have got the shot. He must have got the jab, and that's causing his myocarditis that's leading to the clotting and a heart attack. And there's no evidence of any of that. And so in my mind, Occam's razor, you say, okay, it's going to be one of a couple things. Is it something that's commotio cordis, this well-defined example that happens in younger athletes when they're struck in the chest with a thump at the wrong time? Or is it a residue of a vaccine that billions of people have received at this point with no hard direct connection to heart attacks? So, you know, one of those two is the more likely scenario. And then, you know, if you want to cover how this was blown up in the news, that's really cool.
Yeah, I do want to talk about that. Before we get there, the story mentioned that there has been an uptick in these cases, but it preceded the pandemic. So I'm wondering, do we have any idea why there's been an increase, or is it just, we're just guessing at this point?
you know, there's a lot of this online and a lot of people who are talking about this in different ways. I don't know that, that we can necessarily have any hard data that say that this is an uptick in these events.
Okay.
And when you, when there was something really great that I read on it earlier today, and I was reasonably convinced that there is nothing significant or remarkable about the recent recent ones. There is the likelihood of injecting bias into this, confirmation bias, that now every time you see somebody drop, you're going to go, aha, it's the vaccine, you know. But this happened before. And before we had to figure out what it was and understand what was the basis of the heart disorder or, you know, the heart event.
Yeah. It seems to me, no matter what your perspective is, it would be good to wait to see what happens, you know, because if you're adamantly against the COVID shots and that's, you know, whatever, that's your thing. Okay. Wouldn't you want to wait? I don't think we have access to his medical records because I'm sure that's probably private unless they release it. In other words, it doesn't seem like you have much to go on at this point. So it would behoove you, and I'm thinking cynically here, of course, it would behoove you just to kind of sit tight and shut up. And then when you have more data, then you can try to construct an argument about this. But that seems like we're just looking at it. And I can't help but think that this is one of the reasons it was covered in the media. Of course, he's an NFL player, but this also kind of, I don't know. And I don't, not inside people's heads, but I get the impression that if you're an editor of a newspaper, you could go, people are going to read this because he's in the NFL, but then there's all this controversy about myocarditis and pericarditis. So people will read this article. What do you think? Just overall thoughts on, I guess, the media side of this.
Well, it has been discussed that, you know, this is what someone was writing. Maybe we'll finally start paying attention to myocarditis. We've been talking about it for a year and a half. You know, myocarditis appeared as a very realistic symptom of the shot of the mRNA vaccine in young men, in predominantly young men, a year and a half ago. And these patterns were identified under surveillance, and I believe we talked about them here. And it's not a surprise. That there's nothing new about that. But I don't know that there's been a great number of a statistically reasonable, traceable number of people dropping over as younger athletes. It happens all the time because these athletes put tremendous strain on their bodies. It always has happened. But nothing that appears to be due to the vaccine itself. And that's the big problem, is that the media, when you talk about Tucker Carlson, who's got a massive audience, when he comes on and says, I'm not vaccinated, I'm still here, you know, they're lying to you. You know, he'll talk openly about it. And I watched him talk about it the other night, and I couldn't believe it. And then Dr. Drew Pinsky, you know, who I used to really appreciate Dr. Drew because of his very candid, you know, and good approach to giving advice. He went on Twitter and said, another athlete dropping down, you know, Charlie Kirk, you know, in politics. Oh, another person dropping suddenly. You know, it is deplorable that people would, and I hate to use that word, it is, but it is. It's really upsetting that they would use the opportunity of someone's tragedy to further politicize and further cast hesitancy upon use of a public health measure. And this will be studied. It'll be watched. We'll understand what was up with Hamlin. But right now, we don't know. And for them to even infer that is really, really off base.
Yeah, it seems a little opportunistic to me as well. And even if it does come out that the vaccine had something to do with it, it's one case, right? So, I mean, statistically, and I know people don't really grasp concepts like these when you talk about vaccines, because if you see a high-profile case like this, that's all it really takes. You know, if it happens to this young, healthy guy, you know, what's it going to do to you? And that's a bit frustrating to me. You know, it's like as you said, I don't know how many people have gotten the whatever booster, you know, is supposedly responsible for this. I don't know which shot. Is it just one of the mRNA vaccines that they're saying?
Well, when you look at the data, it appears that the Moderna one tends to have a higher number of myocarditis reports, but even those data are kind of squishy because we don't know exactly. It's hard to tell the rate because you have to place the number of identifications over the number of vaccines administered. And I don't know that I've seen those data. I've just seen the total raw numbers, the absolute numbers. So it's really hard to say, but no matter what it is, the numbers are exceedingly low. And so if you look at the risk versus benefit, and the fact that myocarditis, pericarditis are generally mild to moderate in terms of their risk and easily mitigated with anti-inflammatories, this is stuff that is not a problem relative to the disease itself or relative to the infection itself. And so that's been the big problem. The thing that I've really been pushing, and you know, for thing I've really been pushing based on this, has been the fact that the reason he survived, which commotio cordis, is usually sudden death. And it's described in martial arts as the touch of death. I mean, it is usually a sudden death event, because the heart goes into an electronic arrhythmia that can't be restored. And so the thing that saved Hamlin was this. This is the big take home for today. CPR immediately and AEDs and then therapeutic cooling. All these things were really what saved him. But the immediate thing was CPR. Getting people on him, identifying that he is in cardiac arrest, getting the CPR going, getting an AED on site, getting electrical activity restored. This is what really saved him. And there's the therapeutic hypothermia. Once he got to the hospital, they cool your body to preserve the nervous system and a time of deficit of blood flow. All these things really help in the recovery. And if there's anything that we really need to take home from this, it's that you need to know CPR and you need to be prepared to administer it. And you got to know how to use an AED. And don't make, know where they are where you work, know where they are in the stores where you're at. Be the person who is ready to dive in when it hits the fan, because the worst time to try to figure out how to use an AED is right when
you need
a heart attack happens.
Yeah.
And it's good to have training and to go through it. A friend of mine, his father died and had six guys in the room with him staring at him waiting for the paramedics.
Oh.
And in a heart attack dropped. And everyone said, what do we do now? It really is a case where this is something that all of us should learn from this unfortunate instance. And best wishes to Hamlin. I really hope he comes back. He's a really good guy. I've learned a lot about in the last few days. And he's, you know, there's plenty of other guys in the NFL who you probably wish this upon. Damar Hamlin is the guy you really would, you know, was the last guy you would really want this to happen to. So, you know, and I like Aaron Rodgers, but, you know, him and his anti-vax stuff.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that.
I'm a Packers fan, but I didn't like that very much. But anyway.
Yeah, he took a supplement or whatever, so he was immunized. What's the name of this condition one more time so people are aware of it?
Commotio cordis. It's
okay.
C-O-M-M-O-T-I-O, cordis. And it's commotio, like commotion, cordis. And so it is literally a commotion in the electrical signaling of the heart. It's a it's ventricular fibrillation that is caused by an impact during that specific window. And so you have to get hit at the right time in the right place, and that's why it's so rare. But it happens, and when it happens, to be able to say, in the spectrum of all the things that are happening right now, how do I respond to this? If you see someone get hit with a baseball or a punch in the chest, and they drop, the first, like straight down, first thing to do is check their pulse. And if you don't find it, get on CPR right away.
Yeah, as a side note, that's really good. The Red Cross will train you, by the way, if you just go to their website. I did this when my son was born, but it takes like 3 or 4 days, and then you do an online class, and then you go to an in-person training where they teach you how to do all this stuff using AED. And it's really simple. It's just that, like Kevin was saying, if you get into that moment, you get into that oh shit moment, and you know, it's good to have that training. It's like $50, so it's well worth it. I haven't, incidentally, before we wrap up here, I haven't heard this condition mentioned in reference to the vaccines at all. So I'm wondering, and this could just be my ignorance, maybe they are, people are talking about this, but I'm wondering if people are just latching onto anything to try to associate this with the COVID shots because it's cardiac related and the vaccine may be involved according to the speculation. So what, do you have any insight on that?
Well, if you read online, they call it the clot shot. And right. What they're saying is that he had a heart attack, and even Tucker Carlson said it was a heart attack. He that would infer some sort of thrombosis, some sort of a blockage, that coronary blockage that led to a heart attack. And that hasn't been said whether that was or wasn't the case. But people who are calling this the clot shot base this upon what you saw with the J&J vaccine, where there was the cerebroventricular thrombosis that was being reported in some women who were in their 40s and 50s. But even this was exceedingly rare. And the fact that you saw these rare events and that we are aware of them and counting them says that the surveillance is awesome and that we're really keeping an eye on what's going on with people relative to their treatment with this, or the preventative nature of the vaccine. So, you know, I really, really am not happy about the way that this was covered by some people, the way it's been playing into that. But the way we solve that is by turning it around and by using this as a call to arms to get CPR training and make sure you know how to work an AED.
Very good. Well, I think we're going to leave it there. I'm impressed with this, Kevin, this little face-to-face. I enjoyed it. I had a good time.
Are we doing Twitter?
I didn't pick anybody. I thought we were going to give up on that.
I thought we were too, but you know what? I got one today.
Okay.
fair enough. But let's give up on it going forward. But the one that I ran into was something called Pulse Point, and it's relevant to our discussion today. Pulse Point is an app that you can download on your phone, and you can follow them on Twitter, that when there is a cardiac event in your neighborhood, and police or fire or paramedics are called to it, it triggers your phone. And if you know CPR, you can get over there first. And in the UK, they call them heart runners. It's called, the app is DFib in the UK. Here in the USA, it's called Pulse Point. And follow them on Twitter, or maybe download it if you know CPR and you're not afraid to get in. Definitely, it's a pretty cool thing. I just downloaded it today.
Very topical, very informative as always, Dr. Kevin Fulton with the great recommendations. I dropped the ball, didn't get one. Sorry, guys, only got one for you.
No, I think that's it's so 2022.
Yeah, we're moving on to bigger and better things. All right, but you can follow us as well. You can follow Kevin at Kevin Fulton on Twitter. You can get my writing on Twitter at ACSH.org, and then my website is CameronJEnglish.net. 200 is in the can. We'll be back next week. 201, Kevin. Until then, everyone, we'll see you.